And you can see an extreme example of this when you stand alongside of a picture window in front of a storefront, and you look at the glass on the storefront at a grazing angle, and you'll see that the glass is almost a mirror. At a grazing angle, the glass, even though it's a pure insulator, is reflecting a fair amount of signal. Once you know the wavelengths of thickness of the glass, the dielectric constant of the glass, and the frequency of operation of the radar, there are equations you can go to that will tell you exactly how much signal is going to reflect off the front surface of the glass, how much signal is going to reflect off the back surface of the glass, how much the signal will be attenuated when it goes through the glass. All of these are characteristics you can plug into a formula, a radar-like formula, and know exactly what's going to happen. In most cases, unless you're at some ridiculously high frequency, an extremely high percentage of the VHF, UHF, SHF frequency of the radar, an extremely high percentage, like 95% of it, will go through the glass. At first you say, gee, only a couple of percent is left over by the lower conservation of energy to reflect. Let me drop. At first you'd say only a couple of percent is capable of reflecting because the rest of it is all accounted for as going through. Well, the way the inverse square law works of distance versus signal strength, and the way a modern day radar works where the receiver is 120 decibels more sensitive than the transmitter, so to speak, a 0.001% reflection from the glass, as weak as that signal is in percentage, could still be a whopping big signal as far as the radar receiver is concerned, as long as that glass is not mounted 150 miles away. If that glass is mounted a fraction of a mile away, the echo you're going to get off that glass is definitely detectable. So it has a predictable amount of reflection characteristic. To put it in the vocabulary of radar people, it has a known amount of radar cross-section. Depending on how many square meters of glass, depending on how it's oriented, depending on its dielectric constant, its thickness, and so on. It has a predictable amount of RCS, radar cross-section. That tells you how much echo you're going to get. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, I have a further question for myself, if you don't mind.
I don't know if we should let you do that. Go ahead, Sean. You don't have to ask that.
Okay, it might be silly, but when you mentioned, when you were describing the glass and the radar function, I noticed that you said we get a reflection back to the receiver from the surface of the glass, but also from the thickness of the glass, the rear part, we get another reflection. Is it possible to measure the thickness of the glass if we had a receiver sensitive enough and the algorithms for it?
Absolutely, and I've done that. However, there's a catch. The speed of light is around a nanosecond per foot. If your glass was 1 foot thick, the first echo you get from the back surface versus the echo you get from the front surface, not counting the speed of propagation through the glass, there would be roughly 1 nanosecond apart. It takes a fairly sophisticated radar to see a delta in time of 1 nanosecond. That's a billionth of a second. I have built a radar that looked at a quarter of a nanosecond of delay time, but it required some very fancy circuitry to do that. That was the work I was doing at Edwards Air Force Base at the Air Force Anechoic Facility out there, one of the world's biggest anechoic chambers.
Dick, wouldn't that be a 2 nanosecond measurement?
If that man a cigar, if it was 1 foot thick, yes, it would be 2 nanoseconds. However, very few pieces of glass you and I encounter are going to be a foot thick. In the case of a piece of glass that's an eighth of an inch thick, it's going to be the equivalent of a quarter of a foot of extra length forward and reverse. And as such, a quarter of an inch is only a couple of picoseconds. To build a radar at the kind of frequencies that radars are usually built, and to build it in such a way that it can detect a time differential of a few picoseconds, it is doable, but you're going to have to work very hard to do it, and you're going to have to do it probably by some indirect techniques. In other words, by transmitting a very high duty factor, very high pulse rep rate radar, with collecting all of those echoes, and those echoes would have a particular frequency spectrum to it, of a certain...
Repeater, timeout.
It'll have a certain spectral signature in the time domain that'll become frequency domain that you may be able to recognize it. So, in theory, it's doable, but because of the speed of what you're talking about, I mean, there are very fancy laser pulsing circuits these days that can transmit pulses that are so brief that the light only gets a chance to move one molecule before the pulse is over. I mean, in the case of a laser, you can make extremely brief pulses. In the case of a radar transmitter, we're not quite there yet. So, doable, yes, but it's not an off-the-shelf item, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. By the way, when you're getting a
circuit to detect at 2 nanoseconds, when you were working in that aerodrome, am I correct?
I had to make a very fancy circuit pulsing a doubly balanced mixer, and being used backwards, a pair of them in series, from an extremely brief video pulse generator. You can buy from the Avtech company in Upper New York State. This guy sells these very fancy video pulse generators that'll put out pulses of numbers like 10 picoseconds, and you use that to turn on and off a doubly balanced mixer that's being used as a RF attenuator from a signal generator. By that process, I was able to generate pulses at 10 gigahertz where each individual pulse was a quarter of a nanosecond long, 250 picoseconds. That means each individual pulse was three cycles of a 10 gig signal. Can you imagine a signal that comes on, and it doesn't come on with a square wave. It comes on with a triangular envelope waveform. Three cycles that slowly builds up on the first cycle. One cycle at full amplitude. The next cycle is way down on the sloping backside of this triangular waveform. Three complete cycles with a triangular envelope where the total pulse train of each individual pulse is a quarter of a nanosecond long, and there was a million of those pulses per second. That was the radar that I used to probe for all of the dropped adapters and nails, everything else that was in this acre and a half chamber, the things that had fallen in between the pyramids of the anechoic material in the floor. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. By the way, to build a receiver for that, that's another story. Over to you, John. Indirect.
Question.
It's only my repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, I was hearing you on the input, John. To generate pulses of a quarter of a nanosecond with a very fancy video pulsing network, very carefully tuned, doubly balanced mixers, 50 ohm resistors on all of the ports, because the doubly balanced mixer internally wasn't low enough in reflection coefficient so that the echoes within the wiring of the circuitry, the coax wiring, would create phony signals. And then when it comes to receiving those pulses, an ordinary radar detector has got a radar receiver. It's got a receiving antenna, a receiving antenna pre-amplifier, a bandpass filter, some more stages of RF amplification, a mixer that mixes the RF, the microwave signal down to an IF signal, some IF amplification and filtering, and then a crystal detector. The bottom line is that you cannot operate a crystal detector much faster than about 1 or 2 milliseconds. Now, correction, 1 or 2 microseconds is about the fastest you can operate a crystal detector. I get it backwards. It's 2 or 3 nanoseconds. You can get 2 or 3 nanoseconds of response time out of a very carefully tuned crystal detector. 2 or 3 nanoseconds. My pulses were only a quarter of a nanosecond long. as far as the fastest operation you can get on a crystal detector, that was forever. I could not use a crystal detector. I couldn't detect the signal and look at the video waveform. You can't detect something that fast. You look at the RF waveform directly with a sampling oscilloscope. Modern-day sampling oscilloscopes will allow you to look at the RF waveform directly at numbers like 25 gigahertz and above, as long as the waveform is thoroughly repetitive. You can look at individual portions of the RF waveform at 25 gigahertz. I had to look at the echo pulse in RF directly on that screen. You couldn't detect it as video. Does that make some sense, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet?
Oh, yes, definitely. I would assume that you had to rent that. I don't think you had one of those in the lab, right?
Oh, yes, we did. Thank goodness. Hewlett-Packard 54120 sampling oscilloscope. In that day, I think it was like a 40 grand instrument with a very fancy switching diode front end. Now, I think Wes has got a question on this particular subject. How do you make pulses that fast? How do you make a receiver to receive pulses that fast? And to make a radio receiver that looks at the RF waveform directly with no superheterodyne function, no detecting function. You look at the real RF waveform. You first tell somebody that's got a lot of radio experience that's what you intend to do, and he says, you're crazy. That can't be done. N2XJM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
That was a trick question, but actually one answer. The radar detector mounted inside the windshield of the truck responds to K, KA, and X band signals. So then, in order for us to see the significant change in the reflected signal, if let's say we're dealing with regular radar, would be frequency that is question mark, higher, lower, and also do we see the reflection through the glass, but inside the glass to be able to see uneven structure of the glass, if there is something, or the material, or the medium, and to actually.
I'm not sure what the question is, but I'm going to make some guesses. I think you're saying if I have a X-band, Ku-band, Ku-band radar gun, and it's mounted inside of an automobile, like a police car, and it's looking through the windshield, is the reflection of the windshield, the radio signal reflecting off the windshield, affecting sensitivity? The answer is yes. Not a great deal, but because of the way the circuitry of that circulator operates inside of the gun plexer assembly, it tends to reject the signal coming back from its own transmitting feed horn due to its finite amount of standing wave ratio. So the circulator tries to remove the extraneous steady state signal, and therefore the radar gun is only looking for Doppler shifted signals, and it essentially ignores the zero crossing signal, so to speak. The signal that's out there giving you a great big echo, but because that object is not moving, it has zero Doppler shift. And when the circuitry is tuned correctly, it doesn't look for the zero Doppler shift. It only looks for things that are, let me pick a number, anything above 5 miles an hour, so to speak. At 4 miles an hour, it's going to reject the signal if everything is working correctly. That's a possible mode of operation. Does that make some sense, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW, the TechNet?
Yes, it is. Now, second question. You're shooting at the glass from X amount of feet distance from your position, from the radio. And then you would be able to see two signals. One is the signal that is from the front of the glass, the one that is from the rear of the glass. And let's say the glass is thick or the medium is thick and you have uneven pattern inside, which you'd be able to detect that. And following question to that would be why radar is not being used for architectural mapping and tracing.
Well, nowadays they've got some very fancy circuitry that'll do architectural mapping by way of a laser network, a LIDAR, and that does an extremely good job. You don't have to do it in RF. You get much higher resolution, much sharper beam width and whatever out of lasers. But when it comes to the ideal operation of your radar gun, you'd like to stick it out the side window so that it's looking straight into the air. But yes, you could operate it through the glass. And because the beam width of the signal coming out of the horn of the radar is fairly narrow as far as the size of the windshield itself, whether you've got it mounted 6 inches from the windshield, 1 foot, or 2 foot from the windshield, the total amount of echo you get from that windshield doesn't change very much, because now that horn is either looking at a small number of square inches of windshield or a large number of square inches of windshield at a greater distance. Therefore, the signal tends to be nearly constant in amplitude. That's what I think you were asking. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Another information that is important for me. What frequency is being used? What frequency range is being used to find, let's say, the thickness of the glass, or being able to detect the front of the glass reflection and the rear of the glass reflection? And let's say we now talking not about the glass, we may talk about some other materials. This material is not firmly equal inside and may have a cavities whatsoever. And you mentioned a laser. How laser could penetrate through the wall and to X-ray?
They're using laser assemblies mounted on tripods, and you mount them in four or five different places in a great big set of buildings, for instance, and you can now precisely measure and map the distance, altitude, shape, and whatever of all of the buildings as far as their outer structure is concerned. You're now sort of asking me, do they use LIDAR, laser type ranging circuits to measure internal dimensions of a building? Yes, you could do that. By way of a global positioning satellite receiver, you'd know the new location, and you put it in the living room or in the auditorium and make measurements on the inside. You put it in the courtyard and make measurements on the outside, and therefore you can step by step put it all together. Now, your question is what frequency is used for measuring the thickness of glass with a radar? The answer, no frequency. To my knowledge, nobody is intentionally measuring the thickness of glass with a radio circuit. Could be done. That's the question that was asked. It would be very difficult to do. It's not an off-the-shelf item. I don't know of anyone that's doing it. Over to US, K2RIW.
Do very much appreciate your answer. Thank you very much. And to you.
Okay, you probably got some follow-on questions. By the way, John, when you do put a signal, whether it be light, radio, or whatever, audio, into something that has finite thickness, where you're going to get a reflection from the forward surface, and you're going to get a first reflection off the back surface. Then you're going to get multiple bounces between the two surfaces, and all of those echoes are going to be coming out. So from each individual radar pulse, you're going to get a whole string of decreasing amplitude, delayed in time echoes because of the multiple bounces. Because of the dielectric constant that created a difference when you went from air to the first glass surface, that gave you an echo. When you went from the internal standing wave, the internal impedance of the glass, and you went to the back surface of the glass, which is now interfacing with air, there's another transition taking place. At every transition, you're going to get an echo. So you're really going to get multiple bounces between the two. So depending on the thickness of the glass, in some cases, all those bounces could line up in phase or out of phase. And if you slowly swept the frequency and look for those echoes, you would also get another hint as to the thickness of the glass. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, that brings up another question, if I may. The internal distance between the front and back of the glass.
that can wind up, because we pass through the front, we bounce off the rear, now we come to the front, some of that is going to bounce off again and go back to the rear. We've established some kind of waveguide, it seems.
There is an optical instrument, I can't think of the name of it right now, that uses that phenomena in order to measure wavelength. You slowly tune the spacing. You have two individual sheets of glass, so to speak, that are very parallel, optically flat, very parallel, and you've got some kind of a vernier-like mechanism by which you can change the spacing between the two sheets of glass, in my example, and now you're putting an optical wavelength through that, and depending on the number of wavelengths of spacing between the two sheets of glass, you will get favorable reflections at certain angles, at certain wavelengths, and you can use that as a kind of frequency meter. I can't think of the name of this darn thing. It's got a proper name. In other words, the inventor, if his name was Jones, they would call it the Jones device or the Jones technique. I can't think of the name of it right now. But it's a kind of a wavelength measuring device that uses that phenomenon. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Interesting, and I don't know the name of that instrument either. I didn't even know it existed, but I thought of it when you were talking about that bouncing. All right, I think we still have Richie and who else? Two people waiting. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. Howie, that's who it was.
Roger, Richie and Howie in that order. N2EO, wait for the beep and go ahead with your follow-on question there, Rich.
Okay, good evening, everybody. And John, it's good to have you on here. And Dick, now was a follow-up about LEDs. How are the gentlemen talking about flickering? And a few weeks ago, I don't know, maybe a month and a half ago, a fellow was talking about hash, white noise, in his HF receiver from LEDs. Now, I don't have any of these problems here. I don't know, maybe I'm running a charmed life. Never had these problems. I don't know the make or model numbers to the lights or the fixtures because, you know, being now stuck in a wheelchair, I have to hire somebody, a contractor, do a lot of work for me, and this is some of the things he did. Now, I'm wondering, Dick, could it have anything to do with the fact that we're running higher voltage here? Me and Barry and 2MB measured the single line at 126 volts, and the what they call a 220 line is 252. That one, Whitestone had a different system that they're stuck with. It was a 212 and 122.8. Could the fact that we don't have that problem here, I just have LEDs and Whitestone, but that's the only thing I could say. Yeah, Dick.
The guy you want to talk to on this subject is Andy, WA2CDL. He had a whole bunch of fluorescent lights in the ceiling of his laboratory in the basement of his house. And that particular brand name and that particular model number of light-emitting diode / light created a huge amount of hash. The light-emitting diodes themselves, under normal circumstances, are a very quiet Zener diode, so to speak. The voltage regulator, if they do a really bad job of the voltage regulator, or if the voltage regulator is a switching type, it can make tremendous amounts of hash. So for Andy to try to clear up the hash of all of those lights would have been a heroic effort. I'm pretty sure what he had to do is change the brand name. So poorly designed voltage regulators, which are required on all light-emitting diode circuits running off 120 volts, the quality of that voltage regulator is strongly dependent on how much radio noise you make, how much longevity you're going to get, how much temperature variation and humidity variation it can tolerate, and so on. So what a smart radio person should do is check with his buddies as to what brand names are known to be radio quiet before you write the check and buy these light-emitting diodes for your house. Try to check by some means to make sure the ones you're about to buy are not the noisy ones, if you know what I mean. N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, take one, Sam. We got them. And by the grace of God, there's no problem. Even on 80 meters would be more sensitive, lower frequencies. But on any of the bands, no problem. I didn't buy them. I don't know what brand. All I can tell you is the contractor picked them up at Home Depot.
And I'd like to believe that if Home Depot at one time sold a brand that was known to make radio noise and they got complaints and returns, I'd like to believe Home Depot would be responsive enough to say, let's either send them back to the factory or discontinue using that particular brand. So quite possibly everything Home Depot nowadays is selling is radio quiet. I'd like to believe that's true. Howie, WB2HWW. Go ahead with your follow-up question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Question is this. An LED has a approximate voltage drop of 1.7 volts that I remember. A red, green, yellow LED. With the newer technology, is the voltage characteristic and current characteristic different today? Red LED, I haven't kept up on it, obviously. Now, I know in the old days, we would say 20 MA. When you left an LED, the series resistor was always calculated, the voltage minus 1.7, and you divided, 20 MA to get your resistance. So what I'm wondering, with all these lights and everything, is an LED the same kind of number that you would have with silicon or germanium diodes or transistors, obviously 0.7, 0.3. So is there a difference today? That was my question. Are there different voltage characteristics for the actual LED itself?
There are so many designs of light-emitting diodes, different kinds of doping materials, different amount of base materials, different colors, different spectrums coming out of them. Maybe a lot of them really run in the vicinity of 1.7 volts for a particular junction. And maybe the light-emitting diode assembly is quite often made by having two of those in series, and therefore you'd see 3.4. That's a pure guess on my part. So there's differences in chemistry that's going to make some difference in voltage. They are very temperature sensitive. The voltage goes up and down as a function of temperature. That's part of what the regulator has to handle. And now, in order to bring them up to easily used voltages, I'm pretty sure they're being used in various series and parallel combinations in the lighting fixtures that we buy. Let me drop. Now, one of the things that I've noticed on a kind of light-emitting diode, which is called a laser pointer, particularly the green laser pointers, I've now used about five different brands of green laser pointers, the ones I own and some of my buddies. And many of them run on AAA batteries, a pair of AAA batteries. So you got 3.0 volts approximately going into the regulator that goes to that light-emitting diode. And you get a nice bright green light out of it when the batteries are fresh. I've noticed that when the individual alkaline AAA batteries, which start off at around 1.6 volts, 1.66. If you manage to buy one that's really brand new and just came out of the factory, and you put your digital voltmeter across it, you'll measure something like 1.66 volts. And you put a pair of those in there, you get a nice bright light. And you use it for X number of hours. And pretty soon you notice that the light emitting, the laser pointer, is starting to act intermittent. Each time you press the button, it acts like you've got a scratchy button. In reality, it's so voltage sensitive that the 1.6 volts you got out of the cell that was brand new, when that voltage gets down to 1.45 approximately, is what I experience, for each individual cell, the laser pointer starts acting funny. It becomes unhappy. So the amount of headroom, let me drop. The amount of headroom that's in there between the voltage coming out of your particular alkaline batteries and the voltage that's really getting to the light-emitting diode of the laser pointer, there's very little voltage dropped in there. It's a low dropout regulator, I believe. And so when you go from 1.6 down to 1.4, that's what? 2/10 of a volt drop. You go from extremely bright, reliable operation down to very flaky operation, and you have to replace those batteries. But if you put them in some other kind of a flashlight, most of the flashlights will be pretty happy with them. But these green laser pointers, I don't know what voltage they require. I'm guessing it's higher than 1.4, the numbers that you were giving us. So there's lots of differences, I can tell, in both the design of the regulator, and some of them make noise, and the voltage tolerance out of the cells. Anybody with any further questions on all of the above, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got no further questions, John? Not even a little one?
That's it for tonight, and I'm going to go back into the file and see if there's anything else left over there. I had a few, but if I do, I'll get back in touch with you.
Very fine. It's time to go over to the space report. And SpaceX was supposed to launch today, and it had a sudden change. Also, when I'm looking at Newsday's issue of last Friday, April 21, I find out that China sent a great big cargo mission up to their unmanned space station, which is under construction. And the article says that the space station is going to be completed in the year 2022, and they intend to use it for at least 10 years. So they've committed to using their space station to the year 2032. WS2N with space report number 248, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
And maybe Paul has some information on that North Korean disaster. That would be interesting if he's heard anything.
He's about to give us all of the above. You got it, Paul.
4-1. Yeah, this is WS2N. And, it's North Korea with their missiles that they keep launching and they keep blowing up. Is that what you meant, John?
Yeah, Paul, and from what I understand, it happened after the stage fired, and I wonder if we had anything to do with that electronically. It's just a question I had.
I've heard that as a possibility, but I don't think we had anything nearby. You know, I heard it's possible to hack into these things. Doing it that way, but I just can't imagine some kind of a microwave beam doing it. I think it's just like what we had in our country when we were first launching rockets and missiles. You know, they would blow up on a launch pad. I think it's that kind of thing, but don't know. Dick, somebody else said something before I started transmitting, so I'm not sure if you wanted to pick them up or not. This is WS.
Yeah, I think Joe W2LYY wants to add something to one of these questions. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, it's from early. It's on the first subject that I brought up. You asked about the price of the radar gun. I was wrong on the model. It's called a Custom HR Space 8. And I found something similar to it. I looked on eBay. You can put all that and also a police radar gun. And I found one that looks similar to mine. It's like a 3920, I think, a model. $49. That's the cheapest one I saw.
Very nice. And for $29, I'd love to own one of those and listen to those crazy tones when I'm driving down the road. It's got such a scientific sound that it really excites me. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, with the space report, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, and yeah, he was talking about SpaceX. This morning they wanted to launch a rocket, and I did see that live. They got down to 52 seconds, and then there was a hold. Apparently there's some kind of sensor, it might be a malfunction sensor, they don't know yet, in the first stage. Apparently, some of these items that trigger a hold and eventually a scrub, some of them are minor, but these missions that they have, especially this one, so expensive, so important to SpaceX, they don't take chances on this. They'll delay 24 hours, so that should go up tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock, probably 7:15. This one was scheduled between 7 and 11, and they didn't give the exact time. It's the National Reconnaissance Office, not the CIA, but that group that we even know existed for decades, and they're putting up the satellite. So it's a top secret satellite. They need to get that airborne. And SpaceX is very concerned about it. It's the first time they have a contract with them. They signed that contract about 3 years ago. It was late. At least 2013 when they signed the contract. And they've become quite reliable. The United Launch Alliance, which is really Boeing and Lockheed, has had a lock on the military top secret satellites forever. They always went up on Atlas V rocket or Delta IV, Delta IV Heavy, all built by ULA. Now, SpaceX has become so reliable that they are now allowed to bid on these contracts. They got that okay. They've put out a couple of other bids, so they'll be launching future top secret satellites like this. They say they don't know which way it's going officially, but based on downrange clearance that they need, they believe it's going into a relatively northern type of flight. Let me drop it. Most likely as high as 60 degrees. That's about as high an inclination they can get from Cape Canaveral. And usually when you launch a satellite for NRO or any kind of military satellite, a lot of those flights are geosynchronous around the equator, but this one will not be that way. So they think it probably will be a Mullinar type of orbit. You know, they might go out to 11,000 or 20,000 miles out and then come in low a couple of thousand miles off the surface of the Earth and then go back high up and stay there for 11, 12, 14 hours at a time. And in that time frame, they'll be able to use that as a relay satellite for some of their other satellites, other spy satellites. And once you get two or three of these things up there, you have a continuous coverage. So this is apparently the first of this group. Let me drop it. So we'll try again tomorrow morning. I'll make sure I'm up to see if that thing gets off the ground. What will happen if you go to SpaceX website to watch this thing live, they usually come on maybe 10, 15 minutes before actual launch, and then they'll give you, some information similar to what you get here, and then you'll see the flight, and most SpaceX flights, you'll watch the whole thing, and they'll go up to a minute and a half, you'll see the separation of the first booster, and then you'll see the second stage come on, and then eventually you'll see the satellite separate. When you have a top secret mission, you'll see the rocket go up, you'll see first stage separation, and that'll be about it. You won't know when the bearings come off, you won't know any of that. The interesting part is once it goes up, stay tuned if you are watching it, because the booster will be coming back to Cape Canaveral this time. It won't be going out to the drone ship. Of course, I Still Love You is the name of the ship. It's not going to do that. It's going to come back. This will be the fourth time it comes back to Cape Canaveral. It'll be launched. It'll be landing at the, they call it the LZ-1 or Landing Zone 1 location. And that is an old launch complex. It's called Launch Complex 13 that SpaceX has taken over. And they have successfully landed the boosters in that location 3 times so far. So this will be the 4th time. So I'll be looking for that. That should occur about 8 minutes after launch. So that once it lands, they'll be able to bring that back to Texas, and they work on it, check it out. Maybe they'll be able to relaunch that. They have done that successfully so far one time. I think they've got 9 boosters back so far successfully. Out of the 9, they've taken 1 and relaunched a satellite to geosynchronous orbit, and then actually saved that booster too. It came back and landed on the drone ship about 400 miles off the coast of Florida. So they're on their way to reusability. They've done one so far. There's other boosters waiting in the wing that they have recovered as well. In fact, 2 of them are going to be going up probably towards the fall, or maybe as late as the end of the year, but at the same time, they plan on launching a Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy is 3 of these boosters that are strapped together. The central one is a special booster that has to have different mechanical structure to withstand the forces. But the two, one and the starboard one are regular Falcon 9 boosters. They plan on using 2 of them that have already flown to do this really demonstration of the Falcon 9 Heavy, or what they call now, they just call it the Falcon Heavy. They've shortened that name. So that would be interesting. And then once that's successful, they have a contract with the military to launch a satellite with using a Falcon Heavy near future, maybe at the end of the year or beginning of next year, drop WS command. Okay, now, Dick, you talked about China. They have put up their second space station. The Tiangong 2 space station has been up there for quite a few months now. And they sent the Shenzhou 10 spacecraft up there with two taconauts. They don't call them astronauts or cosmonauts, they're taconauts. And 2 people, and they spent a month on that space station, on Tiangong 2, and successfully went through everything that they needed to do and brought that crew home. It only has 1 docking port on this space station. Very similar to Tiangong 1. It's got some advances to it, but basically the same thing. So since you have only 1 docking port, that means the crew docks with it, and you can use up whatever supplies you have on board, and then there's no way of sending a cargo ship up to dock to another, they don't have another port, so they can't do that. So they brought that crew back, and they want to, or have successfully sent their unmanned cargo vehicle up there. And that's the one you're talking about, Dick. It has the capability of bringing up 13,000 pounds of stuff. It's actually larger than the Tiangong 2 spacecraft. Drop it. Yeah, it's called the Tianzhou, although it's not spelled that way. It's Tianzhou cargo spacecraft. And they wanted to do really two things. They wanted to demonstrate to themselves that they could dock these two large spacecraft together autonomously and be able to transfer fuel from the Tianzhou cargo vehicle to the Tiangong 2. And they successfully did that. They have actually fuel on board that they able to transfer on onto the other ship. And then for practice, they undock and redock again, that type of thing. And also, there's no real cargo on board, but there's simulated cargo on board. If there was anybody on board, they'd be able to open up the door and bring that cargo and supplies inside. So since that's all successful, like you said, the next move is to send up Tiangong 3, the third iteration of the space station, and they plan on doing that in 2018, next year. And once that's up there, it's going to have a couple of docking ports. They'll be able to send up a node-type module to connect to that. They'll be able to send up multiple modules after that. One's a scientific module, and another one for the crew, and that type of thing. They plan on going up to about three, I heard, three different modules. And with that, they'll be able to establish a permanent crew on board this space station. And unlike us, we could have up to six, and eventually, within a year or so, we'll have seven on board at the International Space Station. They're going to have three, no more than three. So that's the story on that. Drop it. A couple of other things in the last couple of weeks. Peggy Whitson on board the International Space Station, she's an astronaut that now has broken the American record for the amount of time spent in space. It's 563 days or something like that. She's still up there, and because she broke that record, President Trump actually had a video conference with her, and it lasted about 20 minutes, and you can still see that. They still have that on the NASA site. And it's been pretty interesting. They had his daughter there to ask questions, as well as Kate Rubin. Kate Rubin is another astronaut. She was up there a year or so ago and spent 6 months up in space. She was the one that first sequenced DNA. And so she was in the Oval Office with President Trump and his daughter asking questions. Very interesting interview back and forth. They even got to talking about the future of space travel and possibilities of getting to Mars. And, President Trump even remarked that, you know, you better hurry up. I'd like to get this done by the end of my second term, you know. But very, very interesting interview if you get a chance to see that. Let's see. On board that same International Space Station, talking with Peggy Whitson, with Jack Fisher, another astronaut that just got up there a few days before the interview. So he got to say a couple comments too about his flight up there and what he was thinking about it, about the space program. He's a first time flyer, and they'll be up there for probably about 6 months or so. And that's pretty much it for now. I'll turn it back to you. There's more things in the news, but we'll just pick up for now. KQRIW, this is WS2M for just making that report for the TechNet.
When it comes to the Chinese space station. The first one, I think, was called Tiangong number 1. The one that's up there now is Tiangong number 2. And you said that next year they're going to launch Tiangong number 3. Is that a completely separate space station? Or Tiangong 3, a module with that name is going to be added to the current Tiangong number 2? Tiangong number 1, I presume when they stopped using it, they allowed it to re-enter the atmosphere. That's a guess on my part. Number 2 is up there right now, and number 3 is about to be launched. Is that the third space station, or is that a third module? WS2N, KQRIW, Greg Holt.
That will be the third space station. So the first one was up there a couple of years ago, and they sent a couple of different crews up. One crew would go up, crew would come down, and then another crew would go up. In fact, they were sending three at a time, and they would return. And they just wanted to see if they had the capability to launch a space station occupied and come back. They would stay for a week or so, 10 days, I think it was. And they would return, no cargo vehicle, nothing like that. Now, that one is right now, presently, spinning out of control. Eventually, it's going to burn up in the atmosphere. The second one that's up there now was a duplicate of Tiangong 1, in case the Tiangong 1 couldn't make it. They wanted to utilize this thing, because it only has the one port on it, for testing. And they wanted to be able to see if they could send a Progress type of cargo vehicle, except this was a lot bigger. Progress for the Russians brings up about 6,000 pounds, and bring up 13,000 pounds, so much larger. And they successfully did that. And they also wanted to show that they could have a good long time in space. So when the first and only crew went up, they stayed for 1 month. And to make the supplies last, just sent two people up instead of three. So Tiangong 3 will be launched next year, probably, the fall or something, maybe September, I read, but sometimes these things are delayed. But next year, anyway, they'll launch the third version, completely separate. They use the same inclination of the other previous space stations, Tiangong 1, Tiangong 2, which is roughly around 42 degrees, give you an idea. The International Space Station is 6.1 degrees. So, it's a bit of a difference. And when we had Skylab, I think that was 28 degrees. I'm off by a couple of degrees here and there, but it's roughly in that area. So the only thing they have in common is inclination that they'll be in, and 42 degree inclination. But yes, a completely different space station. And it's got the two ports on there. See, that's the port on the drop. Because they could attach a node, and the node is really nothing but a module. Six-sided, six-ported module. Sending a dice up there, it's got six sides, and each side will have a port, so they can attach anything they want to it, and they'll attach that, and then coming out from the side, they'll have two other modules, and then one of the other ports they'll utilize. So in the beginning, they'll utilize one, two, three, that's just four ports. Tiangong 1, Tiangong 3 space station will be attached to one port, and then another port will be another module, and another port will be another module, and then the fourth port will be another docking location for cargo, for cargo vessels to attach to. And then the other original port, Tiangong 2 has two ports, will be for crew. So that's the way they got it all figured out. We'll see what happens. Let me drop it. WS2N. You're right, Nick. By the time they finish building these three modules with a node able to occupy it, it would be completed in 2022, and then they plan on keeping it for at least 10 years. Now, that's interesting because the International Space Station right now is guaranteed to 2024. Now, two groups, United States and it's Russia. Russia has agreed to keep it going until 2028. So now we just got to find up European Space Agency in Japan. And that's about it. So you're right about three different space stations.
So Tiangong 1 was the first one occupied for a short period of time. I think you said a month. Well, maybe that was number 2. But now it's tumbling out of control and it's about to re-enter sometime in the future. Tiangong 2 will be completed in its construction in the year 2022 and used for 10 more years. So it's going to be used until 2032. Tiangong 3 is not another module, a completely separate space station about to be launched next year. As such, does that mean for a significant number of years, China will be flying two separate space stations, number 2 and number 3? It seems a little bit wasteful to have completely separate space stations as opposed to just taking the number 2 and number 3 module and combining them into a bigger space station. And is there very much design difference between number 1, number 2, and number 3? Are they similar, or is number 3 a huge update in design compared to number 2? WS2N, K2IW, you got a poll.
There's a difference in design, like anything else. 2 is better than 1, 3 is better than 2. One went up there. A couple of crews went up intermittently, and that one is the one that's tumbling out of space. 2 is up there now. One crew went up there with just 2 people, and they stayed for a month. They wanted to see if they could do long term. They succeeded in that, and they brought them back. And then they sent the supply vehicle up to test to see if they could dock with it, fuel it, disconnect, redock again, that type of thing. So that's, you know, once that part of the mission is over, well, actually, they're going to use the Tianzhou cargo vehicle. They're actually going to separate from that space station and use it for other experiments for a while before they actually de-orbit that cargo vehicle. So that will be their second space station, Tiangong 2. So the next one that goes up in 2018, that's Tiangong 3. That will be the one with 2 ports on it. They'll be able to build out from that, and that will be their permanent space station. This other one that's up there now will also eventually tumble out of space and burn up. That's what they got. That's the plan. So that will be one that's permanently occupied. K2RIWWS.
Yeah, the wording of this article led me to believe that Tiangong 2 will be completed in the year 2022 and used for 10 more years. I think there's some confusion here. It looks like 2 is not going to have anywhere near that much longevity. Number 3 is the one that's going to be, I guess, completed in the year 2022 and used for 10 more years. So I guess 2, the current one that's there, and then sometime in the near future is going to be either combined with 3 or abandoned. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW? By the way, Paul, on your next transmission, do a sample transmission where you tilt your antenna a couple of degrees clockwise and tell me when you're doing it, and then tilt your antenna a couple of degrees counterclockwise I think you've moved your antenna. You've become a little bit more noisy.